disintegration in the post-9/11 world. Maureen Webb was one of the lawyers who represented Mahar Arar. This speech was recorded March 15th of 2008 at Robson Square.
She's the author of Illusions of Security, Global Surveillance and Democracy in the Post-9/11 World. Maureen is the co-chair of the International Civil Liberties Monitoring Group, a founder of the International Campaign Against Mass Surveillance, and a director of Lawyers' Rights Watch. She's also the mother of two small children, and we're very grateful that she's given her time so generously to come to Vancouver to speak to us tonight. So can you welcome her?
Maureen.
The title of my lecture tonight is Security Integration and Rights Disintegration in the Post-9/11 World. Since the terrorist attacks of 9/11, the Bush administration has been pushing countries to integrate their policing, security intelligence, and military functions with those of the U.S. National governments have been complying, throwing aside sovereignty and existing checks and balances in favor of a security space that's largely being designed and controlled by the U.S. And Canada, our dear country, has been in the forefront of this trend. In the process of this integration, a whole web of laws, norms, and protections have been affected. Canada's obligations under international humanitarian law, its obligations under the Convention Against Torture, the Convention on Refugees, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, its extradition regimes, its privacy and data protection regimes, its constitutional protections like the right to due process and security of the person, freedom of expression, freedom of association, freedom from unreasonable search and seizure have been affected. Our criminal code regime has been affected. Our Canadian Evidence Act has been affected. And our due process and fairness protections under administrative law have been affected, and other areas as well. And tonight, what I'm going to try to do for you is to map out the process by which we were moving in the West from an age of rights to an age of terror, using Canada as a case example. From an age of rights to an age where so-called security concerns trump everything. Now, though there's important antecedents going back to the Magna Carta and beyond, the Age of Rights in the West began in earnest during the Enlightenment. And this was a time when ideas about the natural inalienable rights and universal rights of man were first enshrined in national constitutions. It was a time of great optimism with a burgeoning faith in scientific process and progress and humanism. And it was the time when, as I said, the domestic content of our human rights protections was largely developed, so that, you know, the protections that we take for granted in our criminal law, our constitutions, our administrative law, our privacy and other regimes are something that we've struggled for and developed over centuries in the West. This age of rights was accompanied and informed by the establishment of democratic forms of government. And there's a profound relationship between the ideas of rights and Western liberal democratic forms of government. As I said, the Enlightenment was a time of great optimism when people began to put their faith in human reason to make sense of the world. And the idea that reason was a capacity that was possessed equally by men was really a deeply radical one at the time. It led logically to the idea that all men were equal. It conferred on man a special moral status and dignity. And it suggested logically that there was no natural sovereign above men. So that in the liberal democratic tradition, governments exist for and at the pleasure of the people. The government is answerable to the people. And moreover, the government is answerable to the individual, The individual is to be treated as an end, never as a means, and the individual has claims as of right on the rest of society. Society must mobilize itself to ensure that those claims are met. And though these rights are not always absolute, they are a sufficient force that they often trump purely utilitarian calculations about what might otherwise be in the interest of the majority. The Age of Rights in the West deepened and widened with the advent of the Second World War. Until the late 1930s, the international political system and international law continued to maintain that how a state treated its inhabitants inside its borders was not a matter of legitimate international concern. But with World War II and the mounting evidence of atrocities in Germany and in the countries it occupied, how Nazi Germany treated those under its rule became a matter of acute international concern. And with victory, the Allies drafted the Nuremberg Charter, one of the first human rights instruments under which the Nazi leaders were charged with the new crimes of waging aggressive warfare and crimes against humanity. At the same time, the Allies drafted the Charter of the United Nations, which prohibited the use of force, military force by states, except in self-defense or with the approval of the Security Council, and declared the promotion of human rights to be one of the primary goals of the new organization. A UN Commission on Human Rights was set up, and one of its first tasks was to draft the Universal Declaration on Human Rights, which was a seminal document in the development of a new international human rights movement, and something that Canadians in particular can be proud of because one of our own, John Humphreys, was one of its principal drafters. All of this constituted a new world order which was meant to guarantee both global and human security. And it is this world order, along with our older democratic rights regimes, which is disintegrating as our governments succumb to US demands to integrate our security policies with its new vision of the world. I said we're moving from an age of rights to an age of terror. And of course, the age of terror is what the Bush administration, and make no mistake, the Democratic and Republican candidates for the current race for the presidency, would have us believe that we are living in since 9/11. An age when sophisticated transnational networks of Islamic terrorists pose an unprecedented and even existential threat to our free societies and world peace. That's what they would have us believe. I don't believe that most Canadians think that, though. And I would quite sure that you would not be surprised if I told you that U.S. State Department reports themselves show that between 1995 and 2003, the total number of people killed by terrorism globally each year, the average number was under 800. That's including the 9/11 attacks. And while no death caused by terrorism is acceptable, the numbers, even when inflated, are minuscule compared to the 1.2 million people killed yearly in car accidents and compared to the truly existential threat, not just to our nations, but to our species, posed by global warming, a threat which governments are doing comparatively little about. But, you know, in difficult times, ironies abound. In many ways, the era that we've entered since 9/11 is an age of terror, an age where an individual at any time may be presumed guilty and blacklisted from a job, dragged out of line, denied the right to travel, listened into, detained, and even kidnapped and tortured, without ever knowing the allegations made against him or the criteria by which he is being judged. It's an age where the individual is answerable to the state, not the other way around, and in which societies are increasingly being governed in security matters by executive fiat rather than by deliberative houses of government. It's an age of widespread use and official acceptance of torture, of legal black holes, an age of new large-scale detainment centers being built in the United States, of DNA databases being set up to register ordinary citizens, of centuries-old protections being suspended in permanent states of emergency, and an age of preemptive warfare, where the UN Charter restraints on the use of force have been brushed aside, and in which there are seemingly no limits on the strong, the use of force by the strong. In short, we are entering an age where the most brutal utilitarian calculations trump rights and even the rule of law and democracy. I think, there's just so much to be said about what is happening in the US, the UK, Asia, Latin America, developing countries, that can be said to illustrate my thesis tonight. And even limiting our discussion to Canada, there's an enormous amount to cover. But perhaps a good place to start is with the Smart Border Agreement and accompanying action plan. This was an administrative agreement which was negotiated between John Manley when he was our Deputy Prime Minister and Tom Ridge, who became the head of the Department of Homeland Security in the U.S. And in many ways, it's the blueprint for security integration with the U.S. There's three things I'd like to note about it. First, it's premised on the idea that governments have to preempt future terrorist attacks. Now, this idea of preemption is ubiquitous today, and at first blush it seems like a reasonable goal. But in fact, it's become the mantra of governments, the mantra that governments use to justify their incursion on our rights. And it's a very dangerous idea because, as we see with the doctrine of preemptive war, it can be used to justify just about anything. The second thing that I'd like to note about the Smart Border Agreement is that it's not legislation, it's not a treaty, it's an administrative agreement. It's never been reviewed or debated by Parliament. And much of what has been put in place since 9/11 in terms of security has been implemented in this way, off the radar screen of the public, outside of normal democratic processes, through administrative agreements, through international forums, regulations, international working groups, and sometimes in secret. And the third thing to note is that the Smart Border Agreement and its progenitors and its antecedents and its those documents which came after it revealed the special role of the corporate lobby in pushing integration, security integration in Canada. Now, there's many reasons why various countries are acquiescing to U.S. demands for integration, and I can talk about that more in question period if you want. But in Canada, it's the corporate lobby which has been the most vigorous proponent of security integration with the U.S. And I've heard various figures, but one is that 30% of our economy depends on trade across the border, the U.S.-Canada border. So, of course, the corporate lobby does not want to see that border closed down or slowed down due to U.S. security concerns. But they also see the current security preoccupations of the U.S. as a golden opportunity to push for the customs union and the social and regulatory union that they have been wanting all along. And John Manley has been a key proponent of these goals, both in and out of office. So what does the Smart Border Agreement and Action Plan call for? Well, it calls for common biometric standards for identity cards that can be used across different modes of travel, coordinated visa and refugee policy, coordinated risk assessment of travelers, integrated border and marine enforcement teams, integrated national security intelligence teams, coordinated terrorist lists, new counterterrorism legislation, increased intelligence sharing, and interestingly, joint efforts to promote the Canada-US model internationally. So let's unpack what this means for the disintegration of rights in Canada.
You're listening to the Local Brown Bagger on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM. On today's Brown Bagger, Maureen Webb of Lawyers Watch talks about the disintegration of rights under anti-terrorist legislation and the need to resist this.
Everybody in Canada has heard about the case of Mayor Arar. And for most of us, it's a striking example of how the rights of Canadian citizens have been compromised in the U.S. war on terror. Well, the RCMP's Project AO Canada, which focused on Ahmed Almaty in Toronto and on Abdullah Al-Malki and Mayor Arar in Ottawa, was an integrated security intelligence enforcement unit or team, an inset operation of the kind called for by the Smart Border Action Plan. And the ultimate inquiry into the case of Mayor Arar illustrated the kind of intelligence sharing that goes on in these teams and generally in the new security paradigm. The RCMP met regularly with the FBI and an agency which we believe was the CIA, and it turned over its entire unedited investigation file to these agencies. It burned them into a number of CD-ROMs and just turned the whole thing over. The RCMP in the inquiry said that they had been given a preemption mandate. They were told not to hold anything back, and they didn't. They gave a lot of misinformation and sloppy information about the Arars to U.S. agencies, and contrary to existing protocols, they turned it all over with no caveats about how the information was to be used. These inset teams, which are still operating in Canada and which are also set up in the EU, allow U.S. agencies to share information directly with their host country agencies without the formal state-to-state requests that are normally required under mutual assistance treaties. And U.S. agencies are not accountable to national host governments or national host courts. As it turned out in the Arar case, this is a recipe for the violation of citizens' constitutional rights against unreasonable search and seizure, the right not to be deprived of security of the person except in accordance with fundamental justice, the right to counsel, the right to habeas corpus, and rights against arbitrary detention, torture, and inhumane treatment. Canada proffered him up to the United States, and the United States did what it wanted to Mayor Arar. And as Canada has integrated its security functions with those of the U.S., there's evidence, too, that Canadian agencies have been drawn into the same kinds of human rights abuses as the U.S. agencies. In the Arar inquiry, it was revealed that the Canadian ambassador to Syria acted as the liaison between the Syrian military intelligence that was torturing Arar and other Canadians, and the RCMP. And moreover, it was held that the ambassador and the RCMP must have known that torture was taking place. And in the Al-Malki, Al-Mahdi, and other Canadian cases, the RCMP and CSIS have been accused of practicing a kind of rendition light in which they've waited for Canadians to travel to jurisdictions where they know that torture and arbitrary detention take place in order to tip off local authorities and have them detained there. Now, the Convention Against Torture, to which Canada is a signatory, requires that countries not expel, return, or extradite a person to another state where there are substantial grounds for believing they would be in danger of being subjected to torture. And, you know, in its practices, Canada might have skated very close to the edge of actually violating that obligation. But at the very least, it was complicit in the torture and perhaps even guilty of violating the Section 7 rights of those Canadians, their rights not to be deprived of security of the person except in accordance with the principle. But all of this is just part of the new integrated security space. Governments are sharing suspects. There is a global pool of detainees, of suspects detained in legal black holes around the world to which multiple security forces have access. Canada tips off Syria and Egypt about Canadian citizens. The UK tips off the CIA in Gambia about UK citizens. Macedonia tips off the CIA about a German citizen, and the CIA deports him to Afghanistan, where German officials come to interrogate him. Canadian, Australian, and EU agencies participate with the US in a project called Camelin, in which it's reported their function is to supply dossiers on suspects for the CIA to act upon. And until Canadian courts put a stop to it, the Canadian Security Intelligence Service was traveling to Guantanamo Bay to interview suspects there. At the Yacobucci inquiry, which is now looking into the cases of some of the other Canadians, Al-Malki, Al-Mahdi, and Nuruddin, the parties were asked to make submissions about what the proper standard of conduct for Canadian officials ought to have been. And the Canadian government's position, its official position, was that it depended on the circumstances, that their conduct should be judged in the special context that pertained after 9/11. Now, the Smart Border Agreement and Action Plan call for new anti-terrorism legislation in the two countries. And as you will know, the U.S. Passed the USA Patriot Act shortly after 9/11, and it was pushed through Congress without much debate. And in Canada, we got a similar piece of legislation, the Canadian Anti-Terrorism Act, which was also pushed through before the end of 2001. The USA Patriot Act is a draconian law full of emergency-style powers, which have been embodied in permanent legislation. And in effect, it creates a permanent state of emergency in a democratic country, which is never a good thing. And the same could be said of the Anti-Terrorism Act. Among other things, the USA Patriot Act amends the US Criminal Code to create new terrorist offenses and new offenses of material assistance or participation in terrorism. So does the Canadian Anti-Terrorism Act. And the imposition of a terrorist framework on the criminal code, I would argue, in Canada, was a completely unnecessary thing because the code has more than enough offenses to deal with acts associated with terrorism. But it had a number of highly undesirable effects on rights in Canada, particularly on freedom of expression and freedom of association. First, it imports a motive element into the criminal law, making the reason why someone committed an act an element which the Crown must prove. Except in sentencing, motive is a foreign concept to criminal, both domestic and international criminal law. And its importation into our criminal code unduly politicizes the application of the criminal law and makes ethnic and religious profiling much more likely. And we've seen this in other countries. In New Zealand, they're prosecuting Maori activists under their new anti-terrorism law. In Mexico, pro-democracy activists have been prosecuted. In El Salvador, water activists. In the U.S., they're targeting animal rights activists. And in a report that CSIS made sometime in 2002, they identified anti-globalization protesters, anti-abortion protesters, and Aboriginals as potential terrorist groups. The importation of this new terrorist framework, secondly, casts an overbroad net criminalizing legitimate political dissent and expressions of dissent and legitimate association in a democratic society. So that, for instance, a farmer's tractor cavalcade on the highway to protest government farm policies could be construed as a terrorist act, or a wildcat strike by nurses could be prosecuted as terrorism. And thirdly, by piling up inchoate offenses, like aiding, inchoate offenses like aiding and abetting on new inchoate offenses like financing terrorism or participating in terrorism, it extends the chain of criminal liability in complex, unforeseen, and undesirable ways. So, for instance, under our Anti-Terrorism Act, you can arguably be guilty for selling, having sold milk to Mayor Arar, or been the catering company at a Greenpeace rally. The USA Patriot Act creates new regimes of secrecy, and so does the Canadian Anti-Terrorism Act. ATA amendments to the Canada Evidence Act replace the common law doctrine of public immunity codified there. And that's the doctrine by which government officials who wanted to refuse or stop disclosure of information in legal proceedings had to specify a public interest in non-disclosure and prove that that public interest outweighed the public interest in disclosure. Well, that, you know, decades-old doctrine, common law doctrine, has been brushed aside, and in its place, new powers in the hands of government officials give them inordinate control to maneuver and prohibit the disclosure of information in proceedings, including an unfettered right by the Attorney General to issue secrecy certificates, whereby it's a virtually unreviewable right, whereby he can, by fiat, say that information cannot be disclosed in a proceeding. And these new powers apply not only in criminal law proceedings, but in administrative law proceedings, in inquiries like the Arar inquiry, public inquiries, and even in parliamentary proceedings, with the consequent effects on the accused's fair right to a fair trial, administrative due process, and even the ability of Parliament to get to the bottom of what the government is doing, to get to the bottom of scandals like the sponsorship scandal or wrongdoing like the Airbus or other types of wrongdoing. One of the more insidious and less examined developments in the U.S.-led war on terror has been the incremental construction of a new infrastructure for mass globalized surveillance. And this is a special interest of mine. This is the topic of the book that I've written. And many of the initiatives in the Smart Border Agreement and Action Plan are directed to this. Where before law enforcement and security intelligence agencies would be looking at specific threats in specific circles and following the leads from those inquiries outwards in their surveillance efforts, in the new model of mass globalized surveillance being pushed by the United States, countries are becoming much more ambitious. In the new model, the U.S. and its allies are to be engaged in continuous collection of information on entire populations. And in this model, surveillance is to be used not merely to follow up on leads, but to generate leads. Not merely to catch known terrorists, but to, or people suspected of terrorism on reasonable grounds as they cross borders or send emails, but to assess the risk that each of us poses to the state, to predict who among us might be a terrorist. And in this new model, systems of surveillance are becoming more and more globalized. Some of them are domestic, Some are global, but the domestic systems feed into the global and vice versa. And the U.S. is the country with the greatest control over the whole infrastructure.
You're listening to The Local Brown Bagger on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM. On today's Brown Bagger, Maureen Webb of Lawyers Watch talks on the topic of security integration and rights disintegration in the post-9/11 world.
After 9/11, the U.S. required airlines traveling to or over U.S. airspace to provide passenger information, the passenger information in their reservation systems, up to 65 fields of information, to U.S. agencies. And complying with this demand has required the EU, Canada, and other countries to override their data protection laws. Once they were forced to do this, the EU, Canada, Australia, the UK set up their own passenger record collection systems. And the EU has called on the International Civil Aviation Organization, an international forum outside of ordinary democratic processes, to set the international standards for PNR, this is passenger name record information is the name of this stuff, for all countries. And these systems are being expanded to other modes of travel. The U.S. has a system called the Automated Targeting System, which collects PNR data for all modes of cross-border travel and, by the way, stores it for 40 years. And Canada is going to do the same, expand it to other modes. It has a parallel system run out of the National Risk Assessment Centre in Ottawa, or NRAP. While we're on the subject of travel, the U.S. has a no-fly list, as you probably know, and Canada recently implemented a Canadian no-fly list, despite objections from the public and from parliamentary committees. Now, the government's protested that this will be a made-in-Canada list, that it will be much shorter than the U.S. list, much shorter and gentler, I guess. But the issue is really moot because Canadian airlines, even now, enforce the U.S. list for all flights to or over the United States, as well as for purely domestic Canadian flights. When it was discovered in 2005 that President Bush had secretly and illegally authorized the National Security Agency in the U.S. to use their powers and their tools for domestic spying, there was a huge uproar. Meanwhile, the Canadian security establishment in Canada had been openly authorized by legislation to do the same thing, and hardly anyone noticed it or commented on it, even in the parliamentary committees that reviewed the Anti-Terrorism Act. I said that the new surveillance is being used not merely to follow up on leads, but to generate leads, and not merely to catch known terrorists, but to assess the risk that each of us poses to the state and to predict who among us might be a terrorist. This is being done with a technology called data mining. Data mining is the use of computer algorithms to sort through masses of information for specified criteria, patterns, and relationships. And more than anything, data mining is predictive technology. It's not hung up on accuracy. Really, its developers would have us believe that it's a bit like the stuff Tom Cruise and his colleagues used in the film Minority Report. You know, the film where government agents were able to stop criminal acts before they happened by reading people's minds. This is the same idea, but of course, the real world technology falls far short of the Hollywood fantasy. And many of the data mining programs being used today are, racial and ethnic profiling, religious profiling, are endemic to them. And perhaps it's reasonable to ask whether the RCMP, like the FBI and the CIA, are running data mining programs, especially in light of recent revelations that the RCMP has been buying vast amounts of commercial data. and storing personal information of Canadians that it ought not to be storing. That's a lot of initiatives, and there's many more I could tell you about. But the integration of Canada into this new model of mass globalized surveillance, which is being pushed by the U.S., is turning our society, if not into a police state, then into something similar, a surveillance society. And it's having a disintegrating effect, not only on our democratic institutions, as I've described, but also on our rights to due process under administrative, charter, and international law, our rights to mobility, our freedom from discrimination, our freedom of expression and association, our rights against unreasonable search and seizure, and in some cases, our rights against arbitrary detention, both constitutionally and internationally. Well, I've come to the last subject area that I'm going to canvass tonight, and that is the disintegration of Canada's obligations under international humanitarian law. The war on terror has given the neoconservatives in the Bush administration a golden opportunity to realize some of their fantasies about, and you can find this in their seminal documents, their idea that there should be an increased military presence by the United States in countries around the world where it did not previously exist. And there should be a robust use of military power to advance U.S. interests. And with this has come increased demands by the U.S. for other countries, including Canada, to integrate their military policy and functions with those of the U.S. In Canada, we avoided getting dragged into Iraq, but we have gone to Afghanistan. And with this integration of military function has come a disintegration of Canada's commitments to humanitarian law and the Convention against its obligations under the Convention Against Torture, in conjunction with a similar disintegration of U.S. commitments. Canada has been transferring Afghan combatants that it captures in the war to Afghan detention centers where Canada knows they're being tortured. And Canada also has a Canadian citizen, Omar Khadr, languishing in Guantanamo Bay, who was taken by the U.S. from the same theater of war all the way across the Atlantic Ocean. Other countries have insisted on fetching back their nationals so that they can be prosecuted for any crimes they may have been committed at home or released, but Canada has not. Now, humanitarian law has a history at least as long as human rights law. I'm not going to canvass it, but where human rights standards are important in protecting the interest of human dignity and setting up the framework of our democratic forms of government, humanitarian law has an equally important purpose in governing the conduct of war and in mitigating its most inhumane effects. In respect of Omar Khadr, Canada has a moral obligation, if not a constitutional one, to do what it can on the diplomatic front to ensure that the United States respects his rights under the Geneva Convention, including his right to a fair trial for any crimes he may have committed in the theater of war. We tend to think in Canada that our hands are relatively clean compared to those of the United States. And, you know, speaking of Mayor Arar and Afghan detainees, you know, we also seem to feel that though we may have made mistakes along the way, we've largely redeemed ourselves through an appropriate amount of public concern and government redress. But I think it's a mistake to think that way. In the case where we perhaps behaved the best, the case of Mayor Arar, the inquiry's recommendations have still not been implemented more than a year after they were handed down. And the Harper conservative government will not even answer questions about what it's doing towards implementation. Meanwhile, there have been a myriad of, as you can tell by my talk today, a myriad of new security measures implemented and corresponding rights eroded. Someone once said, a country is not only what it does, it is also what it puts up with, what it tolerates. Canadians have a deep belief in the benign designs of government. And in this age of terror, I think that we need perhaps to be a little more skeptical, a little more vigilant than that, to keep track of the initiatives that are being put in place in our name and to fight for the kind of country that we really want to live in. Thank you.
You've been listening to Maureen Webb of Lawyers Watch on the local Brown Bagger on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver. We will now hear some excerpts from the question and answer period that followed her speech.
The events of 9/11 have really been a spur to the implementation of many of these programs, some of which were floated in the past but shot down either by courts or in democratic houses of government. And there's a tremendous amount of money being put into them and huge corporate interests in seeing them maintained. And of course, once huge amounts of money are invested and you have vested corporate interests in continuing along this road, and governments themselves become addicted to using this information, not just for counterterrorism, because in fact it's being used for any number of other agendas, it does become extremely difficult to unravel. And I have to admit that the more I study this area, the more pessimistic I am that we're going to be able to roll back a lot of this stuff. But I think that it's just critical that people become more aware of it fast, and that we at least start demanding that its pros and cons be debated.
I don't understand the Qadar, maybe I'm saying his name right, that young person. How can he be charged with a war crime when he was just fighting a war? And he's just a soldier in my eyes.
In the case of Omar Khadr, he's accused of throwing a grenade, you know, after he and his fellow fighters had been bombarded by U.S. soldiers in a building. This is part of the disintegration of rights that the United States has been a big driver of. Not only does the United States define torture in ways that torture has never been defined before and they make a mockery of the concept of a prohibition against torture, but they have fiddled with this idea of both whether the Geneva Conventions and international humanitarian law apply to combatants in Afghanistan and detainees in Guantanamo Bay and American citizens. And they've tried to introduce this new category called enemy combatant or illegal combatant, which makes no sense in international humanitarian law. Under the Geneva Conventions, there's two categories. You're either a civilian or you're a combatant. And if you're a combatant and you're captured, you're entitled to prisoner of war status, which gives you certain rights. But they're not that much different than the rights to which captured civilians detained by occupying powers are entitled. So, you know, it's just really Bush administration gobbledygook, you know, which is serious because it's you know, the United States is a major power and it has some influence in changing international customary law just by virtue of its practices and its assertions. So it's cause for concern. Not just in the immediate context, but for the future of the law as well. And in international humanitarian law, detainees are supposed to be repatriated at the end of the hostilities. But of course, this concept of perpetual war on terror, you know, is another blurring of the legal categories. And also it's debatable whether the U.S. had the right to transfer those detainees so far away from the theater of war under the Geneva Conventions as well. Democratic rights and international human rights are designed to guarantee better human security. That's how they've been developed over centuries. That was the idea after the Second World War. And the sort of full-out onslaught against these norms since 9/11 has not, in the name of security, has not made us more secure. It's made us more vulnerable to the kinds of bad things that I've, you know, that Mayor Arar and other Canadians have suffered. And, you know, it's interesting because I testified before the committees reviewing the Anti-Terrorism Act and looking at how emergency laws are introduced into democratic societies, sort of the history of them in various countries, you know, the emergency laws that were meant to respond to the IRA in the UK, emergency laws in Israel. They have a pattern of being introduced and then becoming permanent and also intensifying. And the public tends to accept them when they're first introduced because they're painted as something that is supposed to apply to a definable other, the bad guys. Not us. It's not going to apply to the normal society. It's not going to be sort of normalized and generally applied, but it's something that's to address an emergency and it's going to hit them. So that there becomes this false dichotomy of us and them. And, you know, it's true. In the first years, it is the minority, not necessarily the bad guys, but the minority that is stereotyped or ethnically profiled or religiously profiled that gets the brunt of these emergency laws. But over time, they do become normalized. They do spread throughout the legal regime. And, you know, I gave you examples of how the Anti-Terrorism Act brings in new regimes of secrecy that could have really serious implications in the future on issues completely unrelated to terrorism. You know, so while we countenance the Muslims among us being, you know, unfairly targeted and dragnetted under these new laws, very little thought is paid to them, but also to our own future of how these laws will ultimately or could ultimately be turned against the wider population. And I don't know that I would ascribe to the view that 9/11 was an inside job. I mean, but I don't think it's really necessary to go there. In history, there's a very obvious amount of state terrorism that takes place. You know, it's the state attacks on civilians to spread terror and make populations, comply with what the state wants them to. History abounds with those. And so when you're devising a terrorist framework, it's a very political thing. And is it really very useful? I mean, just look in the Anti-Terrorism Act. One of the regimes it set up is the proscription of terrorist groups. And the USA Patriot Act, or I'm not sure if it's under the Patriot Act, but there's legislation in the United States and in the UK and other countries that set up a new proscription of groups that are defined as terrorists. It's extremely politicized which group gets on the list. And this kind of black and white characterization of historical and complex conflicts does nothing, I think, to help resolve these conflicts or help Canada develop constructive policies, foreign policies in relation to these kinds. Yes, there's a lot of terrorism perpetrated by states, much more than terrorism perpetrated by individuals. But I think what happens for human rights groups or advocates is that if you get bogged down into, you know, this conspiracy theories, which which may or may not be true, and I tend to think that they're not, then you lose the points that you're there to make. So perhaps it's a question of function.
Yeah. Could you name some company names that are the big beneficiaries from this push for security and surveillance and stuff in Canada, and particularly around our upcoming Olympics? It seems like we're being set up for a huge deal here. And what companies are the main recipients of this?
You're welcome to flip through my book, because there's a whole chapter on the corporate security complex and you know, how companies have profited from this and which ones in different countries. Naomi Klein's new book, Shock Doctrine, has a fantastic chapter on homeland security, and I think her thesis is that corporations, you know, with this new security paradigm, are not just forming a sort of symbiotic relationship with government, but in fact are cannibalizing some of the core functions of the state, the contracting out of the military in Iraq, the contracting out of the reconstruction of Iraq and Katrina, all the contracting out of the police functions of surveillance. These are security functions of the state: military, security, intelligence, policing. These are sort of the core functions of a state. If you don't have those functions, you know, you don't have a raison d'être as a state. And these are new frontiers for capitalism. I think she's not only does I think her analysis is right on, but she also has more examples of her and how they're profiting from this. You know, just off the top of my head, for example, the RCMP is buying commercial data from data aggregators like Accenture, ChoicePoint, LexisNexis. These are some of the same ones that are selling data in the United States. Lockheed Martin's name comes up. SizeTint Inc. is involved in developing some of the data mining programs that I've talked about. There's Canadian companies that are competing internationally to create biometric technologies and new smart cards, identity cards, for countries in Asia, Europe, and elsewhere. It's a feeding frenzy. And in fact, I was reading lately that you know, the new boom, and it doesn't look like it's going to be a bubble, at least not, you know, anytime soon, it's not going to burst, is the security industry. It's ahead of even, you know, the new interest in green technology, because it's essentially easy money, and companies, that's where a lot of venture capital is going now. So yes, the Olympics, like you say, I'm sure that's going to be really interesting research to know who's providing the, you know, the technologies and the security for the Olympics, for example. And what's really needed is a new 1984 or a new, you know, Kafka's The Trial, because I think art can get across complex subjects like this in a much more compelling way than, you know, than a book or someone like me talking about it. And that's one of the challenges. I think this is why I think it's one of the more insidious aspects of the war on terror, both because it's hard to grasp and also because once it's set up, it's going to be one of the most difficult to unravel. You know, we might unravel the Military Commissions Act or the Anti-Terrorism Act, but we're much less likely to unravel Matrix, U.S. Visit, the automated targeting system, all of these other things. So I look forward to, you know, we need a great writer to address the subject, or at least somebody like George Clooney to make a movie like he did for Syriana, you know. We tend to be complacent in Canada because we feel that we kind of have to go along with what the U.S. wants, because if we don't, there'll be some consequences. And the prime one is the border. And of course the government is very concerned about the economy and very captive to the corporate lobby. And so it will do just about anything to keep that border open and trucks going across, because a lot of our trade is just-in-time delivery by trucks. And so we're in this strange position as Canadians where we sort of don't believe we need to do this for ourselves, but we'll do it because we think we kind of have to for the United States, but even then we're not convinced that it's such a bad thing because we're not really doing it because we believe in it, you know what I mean? And I think that, combined with our belief, as I said, in the benign designs of government, we have, you know, much different attitude to government than the American people, who have a long tradition of, you know, civic activism. So I think this is what contributes to our complacency. In terms of, you know, how we can get out of that, maybe we overestimate the damage that could be done if we don't go along with some of these measures. Or maybe our economy is too dependent on trade with the United States for its own good. You know, with NAFTA, and you know, NAFTA is not, the United States is not abided by NAFTA in many key cases, and it's not necessarily a good thing. So, you know, perhaps as we refuse to go into Iraq, perhaps we could refuse to do some of these things and get away with it without severe consequences, or adapt in a way that wouldn't necessarily be a bad thing. But down to the level of what we can do as citizens, what I've been so impressed with, you know, I'm based in Ottawa, so we do a fair amount of lobbying on Parliament Hill, and I'm always amazed at the power of a letter. When we were lobbying on the Anti-Terrorism Act, we were speaking to some of the senators before the actual testimony that we gave, and they were telling us that when the Liberal Party receives 5 letters on an issue, you know, the party whip is involved, you know? Like, it becomes, you know, it because I guess people just don't take the time to write letters. And so never underestimate, you know, what coordinated action a letter writing campaign can do, or even just your own letter going forward.
That was Maureen Webb on The Local Brown Bagger, talking on the topic of security integration and rights disintegration in the post-9/11 world.
There's been some hard feelings here about some word that was said. Been some hard feelings here, and what is more, there's been a bloody purple nose and some bloody purple clothes that were messing up the lobby floor. It's just a partner house fool, so all you partner house fools, remember one man shit. Another man's floor. One man's ceiling is another man's floor. There was some strange going on. Some folks have come and gone. Like the elevator man, don't wake no more. I heard a racket in the hall, and I thought I heard a call. Apartment house rents.